time for more movie thoughts, reviews, and royal commentary from Richard Fitzwilliams and Natasha Wanton on the Midweek Drive.
96, eh? 96. I don't know. Richard doesn't look a day over 98, but still, there we are. The sort of words have been coming through on that sort of basis. And no doubt we could look forward, Natasha, to celebratory comments from Richard's protector in the world today. Of course, that would be Prince Harry, who not only is able to actually protect his grandmother, but I'm sure he could also protect Richard as well. Isn't that right, Richard?
Well, if Prince Harry manages to use the special escort service, this, which apparently he believes kept him and Meghan safe when they visited the Queen of Windsor before they went on to the Invictus Games in The Hague, well, they may be back in June for the Platinum Jubilee celebration.
But nobody wants them back, Richard. You know, nobody wants them back. You know, Prince Harry's ultimate royal snub. Are you coming or not? The ego has landed. Why would you actually wish to turn up there, especially if you actually want to have special approaches to privacy and actually you're concerned with your privacy? I mean, surely...
I think you're right in saying that so far as Britain's concerned, I mean, this is the general feeling. I think they're popularity is really at absolute rock bottom. And of course, they're in a perpetual war with the press. We know that. And also, there was that rather extraordinary interview given by Harry to NBC. Now, of course, what the American audience thought of it's one thing. I mean, we don't know. There haven't been any particular polls that I've seen about that. But I would say some of the things he said, I mean, Invictus is terrific. It's the fifth games there. It was a great achievement when he began it in 2014, and they've been postponed twice. He had the perfect launch for an interview that could have been so successful, but he did have this weird phrase about when visiting the Queen, saying that she was protected and the right people were looking after her. It was a very strange thing to say, and it seems...
Richard, the royals are so good at their television interviews. I mean, why would we worry at all about what Prince Harry is going to say? I mean, they're immaculate, surely.
Well, I can only say, I mean, was asked about his relationship with Prince Charles and with William, and he didn't answer. And also, he left open the fact, and still it's left open as to whether or not they're going to come over for the Jubilee. I mean, the emphasis that if you watch that interview where he really did seem very relaxed and he was talking about Invictus and what it had achieved and what he and his family, how happy they were and so on and so forth, it might very well have gone down well with America, in America. As I say, Harry's relations or the Sussex's relations with the British, if you look at the polls, I mean, they really are at rock bottom. And so far as the press is concerned, there's a perpetual ferocious war. All of this is so unconstructive, because my point, when I've been talking online quite a lot about reconciliation, is frankly both of them needed. The royals have had bad publicity over, and also tough time over the last, say, 2 to 3 years. And so far as the Sussexes are concerned, Harry's got a memoir coming out. Is he going to slag off the royal family? If so, whom? If he doesn't, is it going to be sensational enough? Who serialise it and so on? And also, there's probably pressure from Netflix, I'd suspect, because they've had a dreadful week with ghastly results, and the Sussexes haven't yet produced anything. And
well, they've lost all their Russian viewers, basically, Richard. I mean, if they will actually cut off all their Russian viewers from actually watching the latest royal activities. And let's face it, Russia is well known for its fondness for royals. Look at what they did in the 1918-1919 sort of period.
I see, Alex, you forget nothing. Indeed, indeed, yes. You know, what you're looking at, as far as Netflix is concerned, is a threat that they'll take advertising. And when that was announced, the shares really went into plummeting down. The problem with losing all these viewers and the fact that Harry and Meghan have now had a relationship contract with them worth, according to the New York Times, $100 million over a year and a half, and it produced absolutely nothing. Fair enough, they couldn't get the Invictus.
Are we surprised at that, Richard? Not the size of the contract, but are we surprised that they produced absolutely nothing? Surely that's business as usual for the majority of the Royals.
Well, no. I think you have to look at the hundreds of engagements they do every year. Could you tell that to Princess Anne? I'd like to be there when you did, Alex. There's a
chance. Listen, Princess Anne, I mean, she's Chancellor of the University of London. I've worked with her daughter, Zara. So, you know, don't talk to me about Princess Anne. She knows what she's doing. Let's talk to Kathy Manso, as an American observing Prince Harry's ultimate royal snub. And more, of course, is it a case of, well, there you go. You know, as soon as they become a republic, the better the world will be.
Well, there you go. I mean, you couldn't have said it better themselves. I mean, like I've always said, I'm always entertained to know what's going on, but it's exactly that. It's kind of entertainment at this point. So it's like, I'm willing to read and listen, but to have any more of an opinion, you're kind of like, okay, that's nice.
Yes, from the Bermuda perspective, any thoughts from your own line on Prince Harry? Is it a case of, don't be crazy, I've been too busy putting the finishing touches to my dissertation. I don't care whether Harry and Meghan actually decide to go off and fight for the royals in Ukraine. You know, just let it be.
That is true. I'm 5 more days, Alex. But Kathy said it very well. Yeah, definitely agree with that.
With Kathy or with Richard?
Kathy.
Yeah. Natasha, in Australia, carrying the flag for the last sort of area of the outback, where effectively, you know, there's still a sort of smidgen of royal fondness.
I object. That question is so loaded and so biased. Even you should rephrase it.
Anyway, any thoughts, Natasha?
I am really happy they've managed to hold the Invictus Games. I think that they are incredibly important and what they mean for the people who compete in them. So I am very happy that that's gone ahead. I am happy that Harry has had some involvement in it, because I think that for a long time it was his baby. So I'm very pleased that he's, you know, had that involvement in it. I think that that's important as well. And I just, in general recognition for the, you know, the brave young souls and slightly older souls who compete in it, I think that that's important. I was quite perplexed, Richard, because we have had some coverage. We have had some interest in the royals out here in the news I've seen over the last week. There was a big blow up about, I don't know, I think it was actually praising Meghan, which I was like, oh, positive feedback. Goodness forbid. She was something to do with her and a coat, and she'd given a mother a coat or something at a meet and greet or something, and there was a mother with a baby and she'd handed her a coat or something, and they were sort of fawning over Kate's maternal instinct. I don't know if you managed to see that one.
I didn't see this report. The one that's got all the publicity here, as you know, is that interview that Harry did with NBC. And the fact, of course, she went as well to see the Queen, and also apparently Prince Charles for 15 minutes. So we are authoritatively told. No, I didn't see that particular...
Richard, President Macron went to see Vladimir Putin. They had a long meeting. It didn't lead to much, did it?
Yeah, there was a long table, Alex. No, indeed it didn't. I think he periodically was phoning Vladimir Putin. I think that ceased. But there's no doubt that he scored against the right-wing extremist Marie Le Pen when he got into that 2.5-hour interview, the fact that Putin was her banker and she couldn't deny it, it's a fact. So, I mean, I think he scored in that respect. But so far as the war, no, indeed, just seeing someone doesn't. But equally, Harry, remember, was boasting about the
special... Any suggestion, then, that Harry and Meghan are actually bankrolled by Vladimir Putin, as a thought?
No, certainly not. But I do think that Harry and Meghan tend, in, as they did at Oprah, for example, the Queen is separated from the other royals. And of course, the Queen cannot make comments, but she did say after Oprah, some recollections may vary, i.e. a lot of what was in that was either their truth or indeed untrue. And that we know, I think. But it's a situation where, as I say, both of the royal family, I think, would like complete peace from the Sussexes. The Sussexes, if they're going to be philanthropists, need some family support. They won't get it from her family, by her mother. And the facts are that, apart from Princess Eugenie, there's not much goodwill at the moment towards them in the other members of the royal family, other than it would appear the Queen. But whether they'll appear at the Platinum Jubilee, again, it'll be a hostile environment here. It won't overshadow the Jubilee, but what it will do is overshadow some of the publicity, or a lot of the publicity leading up to it. That's different.
Well, as we found out,
I think that if they don't get an invitation, it will cause more of a hoo-ha than if they do.
Oh, they've had an invitation, and reportedly, all of these things are reported. If the invitation has been offered, the issue is security and...
How can the public actually see Harry on the balcony again after all he's actually done? It's irreconcilable differences. They'll be made mincemeat of. Which brings us neatly around to Sean Connery, Roger Moore, George Lazenby, Timothy Dalton, Daniel Craig, of course, none of whom, including David Niven, would have actually had any chance at all of being the famous 007 had it not been for Ian Fleming, their creator, actually working on Operation Mincemeat. See what I did there, Richard? Opened up a whole new line for you. And given that this movie stars Colin Firth, I'm predicting already, given your fondness for the King's Speech, he's going to give it an 8 out of 10. Off you go, Richard.
Quite near, Alex, quite near, but not quite spot on this time. It's directed by John Madden, who had very, very considerable success, as you'll all remember, with Shakespeare in Love, deservedly, and also very deservedly with Mrs. Brown, about the relationship between Queen Victoria and John Brown. And the main thing about this movie, quite frankly, is the true story. When in 1943 the Allies intended to attack what Churchill called the soft underbelly of Europe, i.e. Italy through Sicily, the Germans were unquestionably expecting the obvious. Therefore, the challenge, which did indeed involve Ian Fleming, the real-life creator of James of 007, was: how do you persuade them that the obvious isn't going to happen, and that in fact the attack is going to come in Greece? Now, this really, it's positively extraordinary. It's utterly bizarre. The film claims that it's the most extraordinary deception of the Second World War. I think it's undoubtedly true. The idea was to place forged documents on a dead body, the said person being Glyndwr Michael, who had committed suicide drinking rat poison. I would not recommend it. And he becomes...
Sorry, Richard, is that you wouldn't recommend suicide, or you wouldn't recommend drinking rat poison? Just need to be clarified. No. Just need to clarify that.
Yes. He becomes William Martin, an officer of the Royal Marines, and whole background is invented for him, from the theatre tickets to the lover to also an eyelash placed in a letter, and that letter reveals the invasion in Greece, and the body is washed up on the shore of Spain, neutral in theory, but unquestionably pro-fascist. They know that the Germans will get hold of it. Indeed, the intelligence officers involved, we have Colin Firth as Ewan Montague, a lawyer in peacetime, and he's the romantic attachment with his secretary, Jean Leslie, played by Kelly MacDonald, who first appeared in Gosford Park and is rather good. Then there is the other intelligence officer, Chumley, played by Matthew McFadden. He is also pivotal in this extraordinary plot. And the skeptic, given the worst lines and the sort of portrayal that Charles Dance did in the film starring Keira Knightley about Bletchley Park. Again, talking, I don't know where these lines of dialogue came. It wasn't a question of saving hundreds of thousands. It was a question, however, of saving thousands, as undoubtedly did. Isaacs has a really rotten part. But you've got a good cast. You've also got in the Admiralty the administrator Hester Leggett, played by the inimitable Penelope Wilson. And you have the way this plot was created. Johnny Finn plays Ian Fleming, who was such a pivotal part of it. And the way they deceived the Germans, I mean, it's no spoilers to say that it worked. How and the way that's told, it's amusing. I do have to say that there is this dreadful voiceover from the beginning of the film that there are two kinds of war. There's the war that we all see, and then there's the hidden war that occurs in the shadows and so on, which sounds terribly, terribly ponderous, which is the romance. And it has to be said, both Chumley and Montague are keen on Jean Leslie. Isn't particularly well handled in the script. Does that matter? Not really, because it's such an extraordinary story and because it's true. I was also amused. Simon Russell Beale does a take on Churchill. It's just slightly bogus. Maybe it's the way he wears his Homburg hat. But it's
too much hair, Richard. Too much hair. Churchill was a lot less hairy than is actually being portrayed. He should have actually shaved his head.
That may or may not be, but the facts are that this is, despite its plodding dialogue, and I mean, Colin Firth, yes.
And Kelly MacDonald actually was in a movie long before Gosforth Park. She actually debuted in the wonderful Irvin Welsh novel with Ewan McGregor back in the day. You see, to sort of double check, that's where she actually, Train Spotting, you'll find it was called. You may have heard of it.
I have heard of it, and indeed it became a cult.
Exactly.
I think it was in Gosforth Park she rose to more prominence, was it not?
I don't know. I mean, those of us who are Kelly MacDonald fans and the Scottish lass would appreciate, there's somebody who would actually have that ultimate touch when dealing with Operation Mincemeat. Let's not mess around. Let's go to Yaz. Operation Mincemeat, is it one for yourself?
I'm a little interested. I think since it's based on a true story, that it will give me more insight on things. I'm wondering what new things I can learn about with it. And I'm interested.
Okay. Kathy, what about yourself?
Oh, absolutely. I definitely want to see this. I also am curious to see, like, so I've heard the story before, like the historical version of the story. And the reason I heard about it was because I was living in Malta. And if you talk to anyone who's Maltese, they'll say that they're the reason that it was successful, because no one can understand Maltese language, which is fair. but I'm just curious to see how it like approaches the historical, but also still making it like a dark humor and entertaining. So yeah, I definitely watch.
And Natasha, allowing for the fact that clearly having given the game away, it's unlikely we're ever going to actually be able to use this trick again, unless, of course, it's used as a double bluff. And incidentally, Richard still didn't actually recommend one or the other in terms of death by suicide or indeed death by drinking rat poison. I personally would recommend neither, but, you know, it's just an opening sort of thought on that one. Maybe it's the old cup of hemlock we're faced with. Natasha.
Well, this is a wonderful little sexy gem that Rich has found for us, isn't it? I had no idea they were making this film. And then I watched the trailer tonight on the wonderful recommendation of Mr. Fitzwilliams. And I'm very excited. I've already found the Cinema Times and I shall be going. I do love war films. And the spy element and the whole Fleming element of it, I just think, I'm completely hooked, completely, utterly hooked.
Yeah, when you say the whole Fleming element, I mean, this is obviously what actually led Ian Fleming to actually create the super spy that we've come to know and love as Bond. And I might point out that Amazon Prime have actually got all 26 Bond movies now. You can actually watch them at your leisure from Doctor No onwards. I'm currently halfway through From Russia with Love. But there we are. All good stuff there. Let's move on then to Ruth Wilson. Ruth Wilson, fine actress, But once again, although she's got critics raving about her response in the next one, which again, I suspect, Richard. By the way, Richard, what was your score for Operation Mincemeat?
I was about 7 out of 10. I thought it was very good, very enjoyable. It could have been a bit more dramatic, and it is a bit overlong, but I don't want to quibble. I mean, the whole thing's just, it's a phenomenal tale.
Well, from a phenomenal tale to something which I suspect you will be raving about, but it's rather sad, actually, because once again, it's another one of those personal issues with respect to ways in which you have good quality actors like Ruth Wilson, etc., all involved with sorting out their real meaning in life, etc., mistakenly probably called true things. But what's true things going to focus on, Richard?
Well, Alex, may I suggest that you, before you damn films that you obviously haven't seen, go on a journey yourself, because that is an outrageous...
I have a journey from Middlesbrough to Lincoln in about 30 minutes from now, Richard. That's long enough for me. 126 shame. Miles.
Shame, shame. An introduction, you didn't even quote a critic, because there isn't one, I suspect, who didn't think this film is marvellous. It is indeed a fascinating study. It's a middle-class a woman, Kate, works in a government office in a seaside town. She's lonely, she's frustrated. And when an ex-con, Blom, played by Tom Burke, comes to ask her advice, he spots that she's extremely fragile, and he exploits it, subsequently meeting up with her, and she starts going out with him, and they have an passionate affair, and that affair turns into obsession. Now, this is a dark movie. There are dream sequences, which most certainly are, and the way she falls for him and becomes obsessed by him, the way she's watching her texts all the time, will she get a text from him, won't she, and so forth. You get very, very involved in this desperate dilemma, because you know and you can see, and it's perfectly obvious, that he's a thoroughly obnoxious, selfish character who no one should have anything to do with. And she projects her inadequacies on this totally, this appalling character. Very, very good performances, by the way. And a friend at work, Alison, played by Hayley Squires, she sees what's happening and is very, very concerned. But who can stop her losing her job? Will her comfortable middle-class parents, mum, played by Elizabeth Ryder, and dad, played by Frank McCusker, will they understand? Will they help? Well, certainly they won't. She's hooked. She's obsessed and wants to see him all the time. And he comes, he stays over, he borrows her car, he uses her. It's obvious. And she projects what she needs on, for example, she meets Rob for a date, played by Tom Webster Jones. What happens there? This is a totally convincing movie. There's no artifice. It's atmospheric. And you really, really get involved and hope somehow she is able to shake off what is a positively terrifying situation. He wants to go to Spain for a wedding. Does she go with him, and what happens there? She's jobless and she's vulnerable. It's a superb performance by Ruth Wilson, who I first saw as Jane Eyre in a very memorable television series on adaptation of that wonderful book. And I mean, visually, I thought this was extremely good, but it's the perfection when it comes to the performers that I really, really liked. Climactically, well, it is a way out of the particular dilemma in one way or another, but Alex, 10 out of 10.
Yeah, no surprise on that one, sadly. It sort of says more about the
sadly,
lack of...
Sadly, have you seen it?
Again, just looking at the trailer alone, actually, is enough to actually say this is by the numbers, romance gone wrong, which is ticking all the necessary boxes that actually would probably be best suited by an episode of, I don't know, a decent soap like Emmerdale. Natasha, is this one for you?
I have to confess, Richard, I did get it just the opening of this trailer and I already went, yeah, Richard's going to give this a 10. I'm sorry. I'm just looking at the opening of this. It's interesting listening to you explain it because the trailer doesn't really give much away. You can see that there's obviously something more sinister going on, but it's interesting to hear you explain it. And I'm glad that I got to listen to that because having just seen the trailer on its own, it didn't really excite me like Operation Mincemeat did. This one was sort of like this could easily float by me. Having heard the explanation though, I am much more obviously interested and concerned for this character. And I'm sure if I did watch it, I would become gripped in wanting to know whether or not she actually made an escape. So I think it is one that I probably will see. I'm just not sure I will be rushing to see it, but certainly listening to the review, I'm more inclined to see it now than I was just based on the trailer alone.
There are very dark dream sequences in it.
Okay.
Again, I shall prepare myself. So many times before. Kathy, any thoughts from yourself? Is this one for you?
Oh, man. I decided to look at the trailer and I was like, okay, I'm getting nothing from this. So I decided to do some research. And in my research, I betrayed Sir Fitzwilliams because I looked at a review that gave 2 out of 5 from The Guardian.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh no.
I was going to cite that, but I felt, what's the point? You know, which is going to go for 10.
I was like, what does this mean? I'm so confused. Yeah. I'm going to have to rely on what he has to say. And then he gives this beautiful review about like, gotta see it. It's going to be great. 10 out of 10. I was like, oh my God, I'm so conflicted. But of course, I will give it a chance or an opportunity because, I mean, Richard, you said it. I got it. You've never led me astray yet. So gotta check it out.
Yeah. On the flip side, of course, you could say you'd probably have more fun actually investigating Angela Rayner's attempts to actually use her femininity to distract Boris Johnson, allegedly.
I've affected a couple of posts about that. And I mean, that is one of the most disgustingly sexist, but also utterly juvenile articles that I've seen anywhere that I can remember. I cannot imagine.
But Richard, it was from the Daily Mail, surely. I mean, what better way to actually sort of address the ways in which the devious socialist party are trying to actually corrupt the fine wonderment of our brave Boris, who's got all sorts of things to worry about.
It's quite extraordinary, just to put it in context. Obviously, you sit on the opposition benches and Angela Rayner sits with her legs crossed. Now, to equate that, which this pathetic, absolute, almost...
Does she or does she not wear underclothes? That's the question the public needs to know, obviously. The basic instinct sequence that they're referring to.
It is indeed, and I just... Words fail me.
Let's go to Yaz. Back to Ruth Wilson in this particular movie. Is it one for you, Yaz, or is it a case of I might just let that sail by?
I think I'm more interested in the first one.
Yeah.
I think this Operation one might Ministry. Just sail by.
I'd go with that. The Northman. I thought you were going to do it this week, Richard, but you've decided to actually hold fire on that one, I presume.
I'm saving The Northman, an unforgettable movie in one way or another, for next week, Alex. Together with Benedetta.
Exactly. And indeed,
you see Benedetta, that'll absolve you of your sins, and that's a Herculean task.
Yeah, no, again, you know, from that sort of point of view, having seen the trailer for Benedetta, I've got to say, once again, exploitation movies from the 1970s repackaged for the art house movie generation of the 2020s. That's all I will say.
Wait until I review it, Alex.
Yes. Natasha.
Jumping on these ideas where you haven't seen the movie, you haven't heard what I think of the movie, and you haven't read what others have. I mean, you've been.
Life's too short, Richard. You've got to make these decisions. Make those decisions.
You have been hooked on Ken Russell's The Devils for 50 years. Admit it.
No. Let's move on to... Ken Russell had his moments when he was dealing with composers, what he did with Debussy, etc. What he did with The Devils, not really. Natasha, anything that you're going to add to the party next week? Anything you're going to be heading off to see as obviously you're celebrating a bank holiday tomorrow?
Yes, we're celebrating Anzac Day. So a very happy Anzac weekend to any of our Down Under listeners. Yeah, I really want to go and see. I'm not sure if I'm going to try and squeeze it in. The Lost City, the new one with Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum. That I've been looking forward to.
The chances of Richard seeing that, I would have said probably 1 in 500, broadly speaking.
Oh no.
It's Sandra Bullock.
Oh, yeah.
Some charitable, Alex. 1 in 500 is less than 1%. If I see Disney movies starring The Rock and Emily Blunt, why not that?
Great actors. That's the important thing. Yeah, worthwhile, possible presidential candidates as the war proceeds. And yes, it's a case of good luck for your good self in the final sort of routine. Has all the dissertation now been completed and wrapped up?
Sure.
Confidence. Let's hope it's true. It's all good stuff there. Okay, Kathy Manso, Natasha Wanton, Yaz DeGraff, and Richard Fitzwilliams, huge thanks as ever. Keep watching those movies.
Bye.
Over the last few years, we've heard terms such as the global economy, the whole notion of global boundaries, digital frontiers, and so on, and all manner of wondrous things. But actually, is that in practice impacting on the way in which rural businesses in particular actually operate? Well, certainly as far as Scotland's concerned, there is an opportunity here that needs to be seized, especially when we realise that research released by Ofcom has suggested that online usage has increased by 70% during lockdown, with an expectation that many people will continue to buy and communicate online. So to talk us through some of the findings of this particular survey, and indeed how the need to actually think global when you're actually developing your businesses, etc., we're delighted to welcome the Executive Dean of the Edinburgh Business School. That's the wonderful Professor Heather McGregor. How are you, Heather?
I'm very well. Thank you very much, Alex. And thank you for having me on the show.
Always a pleasure, Heather. And this particular topic is something which is... It always seems to be revisited on a sort of regular basis. But the one difference, of course, is that we haven't had a pandemic that we're coming out of to actually really see how this digital economy has really grown hugely.
I mean, we've been told for over 20 years, and you and I think, are of a generation that we remember this, being told that the internet was the great white hope of the future, you know, for a long, long time. But actually, it took the pandemic to really change everyone's habits and to make people realise that, you know, when they've run out of light bulbs, it's only a click away and things like this. And also, people, I think, didn't trust the ability of small, particularly small businesses, to deliver something to them if they were not on their doorstep. And that all of that has changed. So what I'm encouraging small businesses to do, and when I say small, it might be no employees, one employee, but even, you know, 60 employees is not that big a business. Anything under 250 employees actually is what we would term a small or medium-sized business. And that we're saying, look, let's take advantage of this now. Let's take advantage of this. This has changed forever. This has changed for good. People are now, A, they are looking outside of their immediate environment to make these purchases. B, they're not always going to go to the big, well-known American retailer that we could all suggest. You know, they are prepared to trust other people. And so we're helping businesses to build a business, a really practical business plan for how do they navigate that and how do they turn it to their advantage.
The key aspects of rural Scotland, though, presumably not too different from actually other parts of the UK that are in the rural areas, are things such as broadband speed, efficacy of connections, connectivity. Certainly when I've been visiting country shows up and down the country, that's been a regular line. Oh, well, it would be great, but we don't have 4G. We don't even have 3G, and so on and so forth. So how effective is that rollout going to fit into the Help to Grow programme of course, the Edinburgh Business School?
So over a 15-week programme, which, by the way, is only a few hours every week, it's not like you've got to give up your life for 15 weeks. It's a very small amount, and some of it is done remotely. Over a 15-week process, we help you to develop a plan for how to take advantage of this market. And if you are in an area that doesn't have excellent broadband connection, which, as you say, is many parts of the rural UK, then we can help you to think about that and how to navigate it and how to. And it's not just about connectivity for access, it's also things like fulfillment. How do you get stuff sent off to all of these places? So we can help you to to build that, and you'll have the full support of all the faculty. I mean, I've finished one cohort and we're halfway through the second one, but we really feel that now we want to focus on the rural businesses because they have, as you say, they have some very specific needs. And by the way, with opportunity comes challenge. So yes, the world is your oyster, but the world is also full of lots of other businesses like you. You might be the only one selling your good or service in the immediate environment, but if you go outside of that, there'll be a lot of other people you have to compete with. What we want to help you find is your strength, and then to turn it into, you know, your USP, your reason why somebody a long way away should choose to either buy your goods or use your services.
So let's take a part of Scotland I'm particularly familiar with, which is Pitlochry. You've got somebody who's actually in the Pitlochry area who's sort of thinking, I'd like to actually expand this particular craft design thing to, oh, I don't know, somebody living in Cuba. How can this particular program help to grow, actually assist the objectives of that particular company that might be, as I say, wanting to expand, but really doesn't want to know, doesn't have a clue other than sort of some notion that this would be a good idea?
So first of all, we have, you know, as I said, a very practical plan that we help them to build out. So first of all, what happens if it does go, viral and does go to Cuba? Can you actually keep up with production? If you're in Pitlochry, your USP might be that it's handcrafted or handmade. You know, you don't want to produce it on a completely conveyor belt. So we help you decide what are your values, what, you know, where are your boundaries, actually. And the second thing we do is help you to understand the new marketing landscape, because if you're just marketing locally in Pitlochry to people who are going up and down the A9 looking for places to stop and nice things to buy, that's a whole different world online. So we'll help you to understand marketing jargon and the marketing plans that you need to make and the kind of money that you might need to allocate if you want to market as far as Cuba. And that will really help you to build a really strong plan, the kind of plan that you could, for instance, take to a bank manager or to an investor and get them to back you.
So the course itself, as you mentioned, it lasts for 15 weeks. The next cohort actually begins on May the 3rd. It's not too late for people who actually want to, if it's getting close to it, but if they want to actually sort of get in a final application, but it needs to be in by the 1st of May, presumably.
Yes, we're asking people to register. You can find how to do this on smallbusinesscharter.org. You can find there how to register for the programme. It actually costs about £7,500 per person, but the government is subsidising 90% of it. And even that final £750 that you would have to pay, you can apply to have that waived if there are special circumstances that means that you couldn't afford it. So essentially, you could get this for free. And on this particular cohort that we're recruiting for, that starts on May the 3rd, we do have trips to Orkney and to our campus in Galla Shields so that you can go and see what other rural businesses are doing and how they are coping and how they are, you know, really using the opportunities that the pandemic has presented.
And there is a new cohort that actually begins in January 2023 as well, if people want to take a bit more time to reflect on the decision. Next question, of course, Heather, is this just restricted to small businesses in Scotland, or is it open to all?
It's open to all businesses, and you don't have to study it with us. This particular cohort at Heriot-Watt University is, as I said, designed for rural Scotland or indeed rural businesses anywhere. But if you go onto the website smallbusinesscharter.org, you will find all of the universities that are offering this all over the country.
And in terms of, say, the way in which we've dealt post-pandemic and back to face-to-face teaching, clearly back at the University of Lincoln, we're back face-to-face, and I'm sure you the same thing with respect to Edinburgh as well. Do you think that actually this change that we experienced, where we had this notion of hybridized learning, where we actually had blended learning, you could put in all sorts of other comments in terms of that. Is that something which is going to come back? Because I've had various views from people in some courses have actually gone back completely to the way they were, and it's almost as though the pandemic never happened.
Yeah, well, we're not fully back to face-to-face teaching yet, but we will be in September. And I think you have to remember that 85% of communication is non-verbal. So that's a well attested research fact. So the fact that you and I are talking, but we're also talking with our cameras on and we can see each other, it means that we can pick up different visual clues and we can interpret what we're saying more easily. So students who have signed up for that face to face experience, on the whole, that's what they want. But what they also want is the flexibility to be able to dip in and out of it. So for instance, they could get a job to help pay their way through university. So I think, again, you know, the pandemic has changed things forever, and it has changed higher education forever, and it has changed business forever. But what we will never lose is the fact that people in the end are more satisfied and get more from face-to-face interaction. So that will always be, if you like, at the top of the tree in terms of people's choice and options. We actually run the biggest distance learning MBA program in the world. I have 10,000 students studying in 166 countries, and I've had that for years, you know, 30 years or something. But even those students, we offer chances for them to come on campus for, say, maybe a week just to do maybe one subject. So usually the subject that they're struggling with, whatever that is, they will choose to come on campus. So where people can have the choice to sort of do pick and mix, I think they will take advantage of that.
Professor Heather McGregor, as ever, fascinating insight in terms of where we're heading in the digital world, etc. For the moment, huge thanks. Keep on keeping on, and happy online teaching.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me on again. It's lovely.
Artificial intelligence, the digital divide, the metaverse, all sorts of other strange sounding names and fascinating acts that we may be heading into. But what do they all have in common? Well, they're all technology. They're all connected with artificial technology and so on, and artificial intelligence. But where do we sit in Britain in the 21st century when it comes to actually keeping up with that? Well, perhaps the best person to speak to is the global tech lead for the government, IBM Technology, of course. That's Sharon Moore. How are you, Sharon?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, delighted to connect with the good self. And I can actually confirm for the benefit of the listener that we are both real life physical human beings. As far as I'm aware, Sharon, you're not an artificial intelligence manifesting as a human being from that point of view. So that's good.
No, absolutely not. I am a real person.
But allowing for that, of course, one of the big changes that's occurring is in the metaverse, as we've been frequently told to, the latest Mark Zuckerberg opening. You know, there could be a whole range of things happening. We could be dressed up as unicorns, as dinosaurs, all sorts of things actually there. That's all fine. That's all great. But what about people who want to understand this? I mean, nearly 7 in 10 job seekers and tech employees believe that potential recruits lack the skills necessary for a career in artificial intelligence. That's a bit of a problem, isn't it?
It is. It's if we want to be better, we need to do better there. The report that we have that IBM commissioned addressing the AI skills gap in Europe is exactly where some of those figures come from. And it's important because some of the things you've talked about feel like they're not quite here yet. And yeah, we might have potential to do this, that and the other. But actually, AI, we're already using it. It's already being put to good use. In business, it's being used to help make better decisions more quickly. It's about helping employees work on the really valuable things and predict some future outcomes. But for some of our daily lives, it's helping us find the right playlist for us to match the mood that we're in today based on the things that we liked yesterday. And it's helping us from a medical diagnostics perspective so we get better outcomes for cancer. It's helping us with food and farming, right? So there's lots of brilliant examples for AI already. And we absolutely need to help build those skills across our citizens so that they too can take part in developing brilliant AI futures.
You are, as we mentioned, the global tech lead for government at IBM Technology. IBM itself as a company, long before you were born, was seen as basically the cutting edge. It was the big blue. It was the one where basically you'd have a computer which would be the size of a living room, which would actually deal with everything for a company. Nobody quite envisaged the shift and the market shift to obviously handheld devices, portability, all the things we now take for granted. Inevitably, predicting the future, you can be a bit of a hostage to fortune. But nevertheless, from an educational point of view, how important do you think it is that actually in terms of that digital awareness of knowing how to use the AI as a tool rather than being used by it is actually important?
Yeah, it's hugely important, and it's using the AI, and it's also helping develop the AI in a way that's relevant and useful to everybody. So yeah, skills across the industry really important. I think some of the figures show that we have 7 in 10 people not thinking. 7 in 10 tech employees and future tech employees not believing that we have the right skills across our countries to be able to deliver what we need. But actually, something like the IBM Skills Build program is helping work towards that. So if you are in secondary education, if you're an adult looking to reskill, looking for entry-level employment, you get this opportunity to build some of those technical skills, whether it's AI, cloud, data analytics, that kind of thing. But actually, some of the other skills are actually incredibly important too. It's not just about that. It's about our leadership skills, our communication skills, our problem-solving skills, hugely important for us, this, and even writing skills. So we need more people from a wider variety of backgrounds and diversity and cultures to be participating in the application of AI and in the usage of AI, so it helps solve more problems.
You mentioned that diversity concept, of course. So I keep going back to the infinite diversity and infinite combinations. Star Trek Manta, again, back in the day before you were born. But in terms of that, is this something where actually that strength in having a range of skill sets from across gender, across race, across a whole range of things is absolutely vital for AI to effectively develop effectively?
Absolutely. If we're not including people from different groups, then there's a risk that we will actually exclude them in the brilliant things that we produce as a technology industry. So let's make them even better. Let's include more people as part of that conversation. So as you say, different ethnic backgrounds, different societal backgrounds, different genders, and so on and so forth. The more that we work together, and the better we'll be. And actually, if we only tap what is our existing pipeline of talent, then we're not going to get everybody anyway. So we want more people to be skilled up in technology and in AI so that we can apply it.
As you mentioned, IBM have launched Skills Build that offers free learning, support and resources to foster the STEM and new collar skills from secondary education. I like the term new collar as opposed to blue collar or white collar. It's new collar. It's an interesting line on that line of things there. How can people access these details? Is there a place you'd actually say this will be an entry point, and then you can find out further details from there?
Yeah, the easiest thing to do is have a look at ibm.com/UK, and you can find out much more about Skills Build and also some of the possibilities that tech can give you.
And for people who actually are worried about this apparent reliance on the big society, the whole notion of IBM, AI, effectively controls, etc., is it important to maintain that maybe we still haven't reached the point of singularity where the machines ultimately would take over everything, and effectively both yourself, Sharon, and myself will effectively just be replaced by bots effectively doing the same sort of interview at another level?
Yeah, we're absolutely not there. And I think one of the principles that IBM stands by in particular is this is about augmented intelligence as well. So it's about helping people be better rather than necessarily replacing people. Augmented intelligence, hugely important. We're not there at singularity, not worrying yet.
What drew you to the whole notion of computing and artificial intelligence in the first place, Sharon, just out of interest?
For me, when I was at school, I wanted to be an architect. I wanted to design buildings, and I got to work at an architect's office and realised that computers actually can help you do your job more effectively, more quickly. And that was it for me. I love that combination of solving problems and making life better for people.
Well, here you are, Global Tech Lead for Government at IBM Technology. Huge thanks for today. Just a reminder once again, Sharon, best place to go to find out further information about the survey, the report, and indeed entry points for the programme?
IBM.com/UK.
So in terms of words that have certainly gained currency over the last few years, greenwashing is one of those key aspects. And it's no surprise then that people are fighting back, certainly from the ecological point of view, especially when you see that a recent report from the European Commission has revealed that 42% of companies' green claims are exaggerated, false or deceptive. And to talk us through some of the strategies that they use to actually combat this and maybe actually call for some transparency and indeed perhaps some honesty about this, we're delighted to welcome the co-founder of wherefrom.org. That's Adam Williams. How are you, Adam?
Oh, thank you so much, Alex. Yes, I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Well, I mean, I've just heard on YouTube the song that you've put together in terms of Stopping the Wash, which is, extraordinary in all sorts of ways, basically. And, of course, fully protected by copyright, so we're not going to issue it from this point of view. We'll leave it to Spotify, iTunes, and YouTube. But what was the kind of rationale behind this? Because clearly it's an important sort of factor that we want people who are claiming to be green to genuinely be green and not some kind of odd shade of yellow.
Totally, absolutely, couldn't have worded it better myself. I mean, you mentioned the European Commission report. Obviously, there is a lot of this greenwashing going around. And the problem is, we consumers, you know, are kind of helpless. We just have to just accept it, you know, and it's in an economy that is based on supply and demand. If the brands and the companies are lying to us, how can we be expected to buy the best products, the most sustainable products, and so on? So we decided to turn it into a song and make it the hottest song in the world right now on Spotify and YouTube, and call out 120 green slogans so that if any companies out there want to use these green slogans like the future is green or something like that, then we will sue them.
In the past 12 months, we see 16 advertising campaigns from household brands in the UK have all exaggerated their green credentials. You can't blame them for this, can you, Adam? Because they're just trying to make a buck, aren't they?
Well, that's one way of looking at it, Alex. Another way to look at it would be that these brands who produce goods, they have a responsibility to the consumer, to us, to the planet, to people. And they shouldn't take that advantage in order to just sell more products.
Now, looking at wherefrom.org, I mean, one of the aspects about this site is it basically talks about how green your product can actually be. You've even got a Lego Grim Reaper to actually be the tour guide to this whole side of things there. So, yes. So talk us through this whole process, because it did sort of strike me as, well, is this like Death Clock, but for the planet?
I mean, look, if you can't use humour to shed light on important issues, then I think we're going to lose the battle. So, you know, any engagement you have, either with Stop the Wash, which is the song, or with wherefrom.org, which is our company, it's always going to have a humorous angle. Of course, there are pertinent issues to discuss, but, you know, I feel like doing it with a smile on your face is going to convince more people.
In an ideal world, every product on the supermarket shelf would have a life cycle assessment, but that would take 2 million years and we'd all be dead, which is a fair point, really. So, I mean, clearly we've heard lots of concerns that have been raised from obviously the David Attenboroughs of the world right the way through to a whole variety of folks. This actually goes back arguably to the 1960s, where people actually were first beginning to become eco-conscious. Do you feel the prognosis is good? Do you think that actually that people are actually making those steps? They're not just kind of saying we'd like to make these steps, but we are changing those steps of lifestyle, or in a world in which we're still kind of being informed that you've got to work to the office, you've got to travel there, you've got to add to your carbon footprint. Maybe there are issues that still need to be addressed.
Yes, I think that it's important to make small changes in your life in order to combat some of the obvious issues that face us. I think it's also really, really important to talk about them to your friends over a pint in the pub or whatever. So, you know, you teach a man to fish is an analogy that resonates. You know, if you tell people to be more sustainable, I think that has even more of an impact than being sustainable yourself. I have a lot of optimism. I really think that we can turn things around. I'm not a kind of doomsday thinker, although I do think we need to act fast. And so I think if you spread some of that optimism, some of the joy, some of the humor, and, you know, you shine lights on some of these issues, we will genuinely have an impact.
Do you feel in terms of the way that things are processing here in the 21st century that there's more that could be done politically? I mean, when we look at obviously our leaders from that point of view, arguably in a global sense, whether you're talking about the current crisis in Ukraine or indeed the Brazilian rainforests and President Bolsonaro and his particular approach, you know, maybe the message isn't really getting through to them either.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, there's a lot of people who talk about these issues and how government can help to fix them. And, you know, there are some very loud voices. For me, I'm not going to hold my breath and wait for politicians to understand the complexity and the nuances of some of these issues. I think that there is a duty that we all have to to get involved, to learn, to educate ourselves, to share ideas, to share opinions, and take this by the scruff of the neck. And that's kind of why we set up Where From.org in the first place. It was about not waiting for politicians, but putting pressure on those who produce goods and services by offering kind of a free market incentive for people to discover new sustainable products.
Back in the 60s again, Pete Seeger was just one of many people who actually took to the medium of song to actually raise people's awareness and conscious of boxes, little boxes and so on. Do you think that towards the end of the 21st century, people will actually turn around and actually sort of be listening to the greenwashing song and saying, yep, that's where it started in the year 2022?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Stopthewash.com is going to be one of those digital assets that's sold on the blockchain and it's going to be remembered as the start of a wonderful revolution to prevent greenwashing. Absolutely. There is nothing better than a good song to listen to. And if you haven't heard Stop the Wash, this one definitely doesn't disappoint. I said earlier, it's a bit like a sustainable can of Pringles. Once you listen to it once, you can't stop listening to it.
A Moorish song in so many ways. Will there be a video to accompany the whole thing, Adam, or is it just a case of, no, you've got the sign there, you've got the signal on YouTube, you don't need anything more, just access Stop the Wash?
No, there is absolutely a video. Go to stopthewash.com to find the video, or go to YouTube and type Stop the Wash. I think it's the top video on YouTube if you type that. The video is the video is probably wackier than the song itself. So there's a lot of funnies in there. If you're someone who likes a bit of a silliness, then definitely watch the video too.
Hello, yeah. And just to point out, this is not in any way meant to actually be emphasizing anti-hygienic messages. This is actually stopping greenwash as opposed to actually stopping the usual hand space and obviously some personal hygiene, really. It's
thank you so much for clarifying that.
I think it's important. Adam, it's been awesome connecting with you. Good stuff.
Cheers, Alex.
Today, again, you can find Stop the Watch on the major platforms, Spotify, iTunes, and of course the YouTube. We are delighted to say Adam Williams, co-founder of wherefrom.org. Keep on stopping that greenwashing.
Thank you so much, Alex. Thank you very much.